The following interview was first aired on TBC Radio in Kingston, Jamaica. For more information on this and other interviews, please visit the Facebook page, Connect Pray Act, or send an email to connect.pray.act@gmail.com.
So listeners, we're continuing with information on the Belize decision, and I'd like to provide you some key information on the historical context of the case. Now, the challenge to Section 53 of the Belizean Criminal Code, otherwise described as the Bugri Law, the challenge was brought by, in the name of, the claimant Caleb Orozco, a young homosexual activist. But in actual fact, the challenge was initiated against the government and the people of Belize by the University of the West Indies. Yes, the University of the West Indies really was behind this case through a program entitled UWE Rights Advocacy Project, URAP, which is housed under the Faculty of Law and formalized in 2009. And the coordinator is Miss Tracy Robinson, who's a lecturer in the Faculty of Law at Mona. In a video recording briefing which she provided on the case on July 18th, ahead of the Chief Justice's decision, and it's available on YouTube, and I have provided the link on the Facebook page, Connect Pray Act, so you can view it at your leisure. Miss Robinson provides a timeline for the action and the reasons and how Belize was selected as the first of, not only one, of a number of countries, Caribbean countries, in which the Bugri Law would be challenged. In 2007, Ms. Robinson and a student conducted a desk review of five countries in the Caribbean region to determine which country would be suitable to bring a case. Then between 2007 and 2010, there were a number of meetings held, and an eventual decision was taken to bring the case in Belize. And the meetings were held with lawyers, with academics, with persons involved in HIV work, with members of the LGBT community, with persons close to the Belizean government, and I'm just quoting verbatim from the briefing, with the future claimant, Caleb Orozco, and with human rights groups such as the Caribbean Vulnerable Coalition's community, CVCC. Now remember, CVCC was one of the groups that carried that objectionable so-called sex education program into the children's home, the unauthorized, controversial incursion into children's home with that objectionable curriculum. That was CVC was part of them. And CVCC was also highly instrumental in the dismissal of Professor Bain from the University of the West Indies in 2014. But CVC was a part of the consultation for this bringing of this case in Belize. Then in 2010, in July, the case was launched. And here are some of the factors, according to Ms. Robinson, why URAP picked Belize. Because of legal consideration, Belize's constitution and the law itself, Section 53 and how it's crafted. And political legal considerations. For example, will the government try to undo a positive outcome? So if the case was granted in favor of the applicant, Mr. Orozco, what would the government do? And I quote her, "You don't want to go somewhere the government is going to use constitutional forms to undo. You want there to be strong support for litigation," end of quote. Meaning, if the case goes in the favor of the homosexual activists, will the government use parliament and its constitution to override that decision? This was a factor in the consideration of where to bring this first case, and Belize was selected. Another factor, socio-political issues like the attitude of the church, the attitude of society, and the risk to potential litigants, and the capacity of civil society organizations. These were the factors that led to Belize being selected as ideal for the launch of this first case. Now, at the close of this video briefing, Ms. Robinson speaks to the implications of a positive ruling. And she says that even if the positive ruling is of limited precedential value, there are other benefits nevertheless. So we're going to hear from her actually what those benefits are.
So one is Belize is the optimum country to bring this. The second is we only have a decision of the Supreme Court if Caleb wins. It means that what we call the precedential value of the case, how weighty it is going to be to another court, is much less if it's only the decision of the Supreme Court. That precedential value increases when you go up to the Court of Appeal, but even then it is still undecided. That precedential value becomes really strong if it's either the CCJ or the Privy Council, in this case, the CCJ. And you will already have a sense that there are a growing number of countries which are now acceding to the jurisdiction in the OECS region. Notwithstanding the limited legal impact, and let me just say something more about the limited legal impact. That limited legal impact will be affected by, is there what we call a general savings law clause in that constitution. Those clauses exist in Trinidad, in the Bahamas, in a way or fashion, in Jamaica. What's the number five? Guyana? Have I said Guyana? So the five first independent countries have this most restrictive clause, Barbados. The OECS countries and Belize have less restriction on challenging colonial laws. The second other big restriction is there an enforceable right in your constitution to privacy? And the challenge throughout the Caribbean is that outside of somewhere like Trinidad and Tobago, it is not so clear, and Jamaica has the problem of the savings law clause, it's not so clear whether you have an enforceable right to privacy. So there are difficulties in making the exact same legal claim made in Belize in many other Caribbean countries, not impossible, but you may find that arguing that this case means in my country the law is not good may be a difficult argument to make. Nevertheless, there are more general implications. If the language of the court is positive about the human rights of LGBT persons, talks about their rights to privacy, equality, dignity, then even though you may have hindrances in specific countries to making the exact same claim, it will have significance throughout the region. It will change the way people begin to talk about the human rights of LGBT persons, and that will have the sanction of courts now for the first time. And the second thing is that even if it has limited precedential value, it can also provide impetus for law reform, for international action, for changing the mood and the spirit of conversations about the human rights of LGBT persons.
So that was and is the plan of the University of the West Indies for the Caribbean to challenge these laws that are family friendly, that protect children, that put a boundary around abnormal, wrong sexual behaviors, that protect society. So the savings law clause is not a problem, you know. It is a good thing to help save us from legal challenges that are without merit. So that was Belize, and it's not over yet. I will be talking with Pastor Sturm later on for you to hear what is happening in Belize. And we know that the Jamaican case has started. Is that part of UWIS plan? Now, you can look on UWIS website for yourself and check out what they say their mission is and their vision and their core values. And we can debate whether this is the role of the University of the West Indies, whether it has a mandate to pursue constitutional court cases against Caribbean governments. But if UWIS thinks that it has a cause, then it must justify that cause. So is there really a cause? Is there a segment of the Caribbean population that is being denied just enjoyment of a legitimate human right and fundamental freedom? In other words, is there such a thing as LGBT rights? But we're going to look at that after the break. So listeners, the question, is there such a thing as LGBT rights? Are they being denied a right? Is there a legitimate human right and fundamental freedom that persons who are self-identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, that they're not being allowed to enjoy? Well, right now, and back in 2007 when UWRAP began its work, you and I and any person self-identifying as LGBT, we have the same rights. We have human rights. We are human. We're born with equal worth and all lives matter. And we're all subject to the same laws. They have human rights and fundamental freedoms. So when you really pare down this talk about LGBT so-called rights, it is really about reinterpreting human rights doctrine to upgrade a personal preference of sexual behavior to a level of a right. Why? because human rights enjoy legal and political weight. But the fact is, not all forms of behavior are legally or morally equal. Not all behaviors are good for the individual and the community, and particularly inherently risky and unhealthy practices with known statistical negative outcomes. And not all groups which are minority in number are recognized legal minorities. And freedom without any kind of boundary leads to anarchy. There is no human right to sex, and there is no fundamental freedom to engage in any kind of sexual behavior. Now, this concept of sexual rights is being pushed by activists nationally and internationally, but the concept is not an accepted part of international law. Many member states at the UN, United Nations, regularly reject the idea of sexual rights in the discussions in the UN meetings. The African group has 53 nations, the members of the Islamic Conference, and CARICOM have spoken at UN meetings to say that there is no universal agreement on the notions of sexual and reproductive rights or sexual orientation, sexuality, sexual education, gender identity under existing international agreed human rights. And interestingly, the US government, which is a strong promoter of so-called sexual rights, it has said at UN meetings that while it chooses to use the term sexual rights, no one is obliged to. And let me quote Mr. Richard Erdman, who is a senior advisor and acting ECOSOC ambassador to the U.S. mission in New York, the UN, to the UN in New York. And he said this in September 2015. Sexual rights are not human rights, and they're not enshrined in international human rights law. They're not legally binding. And the U.S.'s use of the term does not reflect a view that they are part of customary international law. So the U.S. chooses to use the term. It wants to recognize a claim as a right, but that is not part of international law. The U.S. has admitted as such. But the international activism persists, and attempts are being made to reinterpret the word sex to mean sexual orientation. That is to say that the biological fact of your anatomy should really mean what you desire to do with your anatomy. And this is what the Chief Justice did in the Belize case, rewriting their constitution without the knowledge and without the permission of the people of Belize, to say that in their non-discrimination clause in the constitution, that sex should include sexual orientation. And he cited for his justification a recommendation from a UN body, the Human Rights Committee. And he cited the case of Toonen versus Australia, which was in 1997. Now, Mr. Toonen was a homosexual Australian. He challenged the constitutionality of the Buggery Law in the state of Tasmania in Australia. And he brought his case. He wasn't successful there, so he brought his case to the UN's Human Rights Committee, which monitors implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights of 1966, the ICCPR. And if you look at the case, the arguments that he makes in this case are very similar to the arguments that were made by Mr. Orozco in Belize and by Mr. Jagai and Mr. Tomlinson here in Jamaica. And the committee heard his case, and the committee agreed with Mr. Toonen, and the committee said that sex should include sexual orientation. Sex in Articles 2 and 26 of the Covenant, which we're talking about non-discrimination clauses, should include sexual orientation. And now the Chief Justice of Belize was of the view that this recommendation by this committee was binding on Belize, but it isn't. It's not binding on Belize. It's not binding on Jamaica. It's not even binding on Australia. And let me read for you the opinion of the learned Jamaican international law expert, Professor Stephen Vassiani, who wrote this following comment in the Gleaner back in 2006, when he was then the Deputy Solicitor General. Now, he had heard a representative of the pro-LGBT group NGO Human Rights Watch. They were on Jamaican radio claiming that because Jamaica retained the Buggery Law, Jamaica was in breach of her international obligations because of this decision in Toonen. Well, Professor Vassiani called into the radio show and then followed up in writing with this opinion piece in the Gleaner. And he said, let me quote you, "This is misleading advocacy. First, the United Nations Human Rights Committee is not a court of law. It makes recommendations to countries. these recommendations are not binding in the way that the decision of a court is binding in law. For the Human Rights Committee, in this Tunin case, it's mandated only to put forward its views to the state party concerned and to the individual. Putting forward views is hardly the language of binding commitment. States, including Jamaica, have never accepted that views put forward by the Human Rights Committee amount to law. So the Human Rights Watch representative is simply wrong when she implies that the Tunin case creates a binding obligation on Jamaican in international law. Second, there is no treaty that expressly states that homosexual sex must be regarded as lawful. Custom, as evidenced by the general practice of countries, does not support the right to this activity. For countries leave each other to determine what their local laws will be on the subject. And there has never been a general principle accepted by countries as applicable to the issue. Finally, I think that the Human Rights Watch representative has confused herself by mixing up what she wants international law to say with what international law actually says. No treaty requires Jamaica to recognize homosexual sex as lawful. She wants a different conclusion, so she relies on the recommendation of the Human Rights Committee as if recommendations are binding law. They are not. End of quote. Well, the Chief Justice also, in my opinion, has confused himself or allowed himself to be confused to say that this recommendation is binding on Belize. Possibly he wants international law to say that, and it doesn't, and he has put this into this decision, but Tunin is not binding on anybody, and it's not binding on Belize. And it is not correct for him to have reread or reinterpreted the Constitution to say that sex equals sexual orientation. There is no ground on which he could say so. Now, also to share with you some other wider historical context to understand the context in which this case was brought. There's no such thing as an LGBT right. Tunin is not binding. And what about this concept of sexual so-called rights? The push in modern times for sexual autonomy, because that's really what it's about, you know, this sexual so-called rights. It's about freedom without restraint. Nobody's to say anything. By making this claim that you have a right to do whatever you want with your body, nobody's to say anything. So this push for sexual autonomy without restraint grew out of the 1960s sexual revolution. And we've spoken about the father of sexual revolution, Dr. Alfred Kinsey, the American scientist. He wrote these two publications, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male in 1948 and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female in 1953. Together, they're known as the Kinsey Reports. And remember, in those books, he claimed that the majority of Americans were engaging in every type of sexual behavior, promiscuity, adultery, homosexuality, pedophilia, bestiality, among others. He said that abortion was common among married and single women, that rape was harmless, that children were sexual from birth and they should be taught masturbation and that they would benefit from incest and pedophilia. This is what Alfred Kinsey claimed in his books. Now, at the time of the publication of those books, the criminal laws in the U.S. permitted only permitted sexual intercourse between a married man and his wife. And let's just also say that it is incorrect to say buggery is anal intercourse or anal sex. No, it's anal penetration. It is buggery. Now, Alfred Kinsey, by these claims that he's making in his books, he painted the picture that the law was out of sync with existing social norms and personal needs and that it should change. And his arguments were accepted and backed and promoted by academia, media, finance, big finance, for example, the Rockefeller Foundation, and some churches. And as a result of this acceptance by these influential stakeholders in society, over 50 laws relating to sexual offenses were changed in the U.S. over the years. But the black and white data in Kinsey's publication was ignored. You could take up the books and see it for yourself. Tables 31 to 34 listed the subjects that he investigated for his studies. And who were they? Babies and children. And those tables 31 to 34 listed the timing of orgasms in children who were abused, aged 2 months, 5 months, a year, up to 14 years. And what did he call orgasms? Terror, crying, screaming, convulsions, fainting, fighting off the adult predator. Where did he get the information from? From the journals of two known pedophiles, an American and a German Nazi. They kept journals of their abuse of hundreds of children. And they sent Alfred Kinsey their notes, and he also instructed them on how to collect that data. And members of his research team knew, but they said nothing about the sources of information. His methodology in amassing the data was also flawed. His adult population samples were drawn from 1,400 sex offenders who were in jail at the time of his research. And this included prostitutes and pimps and rapists and pedophiles. And he called these persons the average American. Now, his staff members were also expected to participate in prohibited sexual acts with each other, which were filmed. And Alfred Kinsey was also himself a sexual pervert, according to his biographer, a sadomasochist, bisexual, and possibly pedophile. His findings were fraudulent, and it's just bad science, and his conduct evil, and he's dead. But his ideas live on because somebody wants them to be true. Now, what are some of the spin-offs of Alfred Kinsey's findings? Well, we've spoken about the Kinsey Institute, which then birthed SECUS, Sexuality Information and Education Council of the U.S., SECUS, which spearheaded and developed CSE. Remember, Corrupt Sneaky Education, otherwise known as Comprehensive Sexuality Education, that objectionable curriculum sneaked into the HFLE program, the Children's Home, the UNICEF Teacher Training Manual, and the Macmillan HFE primary level books, which are in your bookstores. That came out of Alfred Kinsey. And a key partner with SECUS in disseminating Kinsey's curriculum is IPPF, the International Planned Parenthood Federation. And in fact, it was IPPF's all-in-one curriculum that was the basis of the HFLE text back in 2012. And here's the interesting thing. The expert witness on human sexuality for the claimant, Mr. Orozco, in Belize, in the Belize case, was Dr. Jacqueline Sharp. And she was the IPPF president from 2006 to 2011. And she also spearheaded the drafting and release of IPPF's Sexual Rights Declaration in 2008. Kinsey in the case in Belize. Another spin-off, a young college student read the Kinsey reports and decided to become Kinsey's pamphleteer to spread Kinsey's message far and wide. And so he built the billion-dollar mind-poisoning empire of pornography. What's the name of that college student? Hugh Hefner. And he built up Playboy. And he also gave money, he gave financial grants to set up SECUS, which really and truly became the educational arm, the child educational arm of Playboy. Another spin-off, the American Psychiatric Association, APA, their decision in 1974 to declassify homosexuality from being listed as a mental disorder. And this was by vote. This is not by reference to science, but by vote to say that homosexuality is no longer a mental disorder and it's now to be considered normal. And that vote and the decision taken was directly related to Kinsey's reports. The rationale that was used by that committee was completely from Kinsey. Another spin-off, the 1957 UK report of the Departmental Committee on Homosexual Offences and Prostitution, which was chaired by Lord Wolfenden. It's popularly referred to as the Wolfenden Committee. And the committee made recommendations to the UK Parliament that it should decriminalize consensual buggery between men. Now, the Chief Justice of Belize mentioned the Wolfenden recommendations. He thought it worthy to mention the report. But you need to understand that the Wolfenden report also relied on Kinsey. You can read it for yourself. It cited Kinsey's statistics and his conclusions. They applied it to their reasoning and their eventual recommendation to the UK Parliament in 1957 to decriminalize buggery, and which the UK Parliament did do in 1967. Now, it's instructive to note from the records of the UK parliamentary debates on the recommendations, and they took 10 years, 1957 to 1967. When you look at the records, no one None of the members of parliament, not those in favor of decriminalizing, not those in favor of retaining it, no one said that homosexuality and its sexual acts were natural or normal or right. No one did. No one said that marriage should be redefined or extended to homosexuals. No one did. The primary motivation for those in favor of decriminalization was that incarceration, in their opinion, was not an effective deterrent or the best treatment for the condition, and rather it would exacerbate the incidence of homosexual encounters. They were concerned about treating this condition. And many also warned that repealing the law would make adolescent boys more vulnerable to predators. Well, we can see what has happened in the 50 years since, and the rise of HIV/AIDS rates in one particular community, the community of men who have sex with men and boys, because when you look at those rates, the ages at which persons, these males, are contracting this disease get younger and younger. And the Ministry of Health in June released a report to say that it is our boys who are more at risk for contracting HIV/AIDS, and the ages are younger. Is that not evidence of this warning coming to fruition, that the boys are made more vulnerable to predators? And interestingly, the Church of England back in the 50s in the UK was in favor of repeal to help the homosexual. They thought that they would help the homosexual by having this law repealed. That's what the Church of England thought. But here they are now, more than 50 years later, where the Church of England has had to get special protection in order not to be forced to perform same-sex marriages on its premises. And here you are, no more than 50 years later, where offering therapy to persons struggling with same-sex attraction is under threat in the UK. And in fact, it has been banned in some states in the USA. So this is the historical context in which we need to examine any challenge to the Buggery Law brought in the Caribbean. And you will understand that the history, the development, and the spread of this concept of sexual rights is really one of fraud, of deception, of lies. So whenever you hear about legal challenges to the Buggery Law, remember Alfred Kinsey and Tables 31 to 34 and those abused children. Whenever you hear about comprehensive sexuality education, remember Alfred Kinsey and those abused children. When you hear about business and media campaigns calling for Respect Jamaica, to respect sexual orientation and gender identity, remember Alfred Kinsey and Tables 31 to 34. When you hear calls for children to be given access to contraceptives and reproductive services, remember Alfred Kinsey and Tables 31 to 34. When you hear calls for reforming the Sexual Offences Act to be gender and orifice neutral, remember Alfred Kinsey and Tables 31 to 34. Calling this morally contentious and deceiving issue a right is simply a ploy to avoid honest debate about the history, about the impact of normalizing homosexual behavior and ideology, and the fact that there are legitimate needs of persons who are struggling with same-sex attraction and they're entitled to seek help, therapy, and counseling. Now, URAP, UA Rights Advocacy Project, they may really believe that this is a legal issue to pursue, you know, but they're intelligent enough to think it through and understand that this is really a political agenda to reorganize society and to abolish human identity, for people to become social constructs, not what biology and anatomy indicate that you are, but what the state says you are allowed to be. Now, listeners, this morning we paid tribute to a Jamaican intellectual who, in all humility, recognized the source of his ability to learn, to reason, to express creative thought, and he dedicated his talent to the pursuit and dissemination of truth. Reverend Earl Thames could have had multiple doctorates and professorships if he wished to pursue academics for the sake of academia, and if that was in his interest, but it wasn't. And this case in Belize and whichever other Caribbean countries were planned for, those persons behind it are also intellectuals with God-given abilities. But in whose interest are they working? And quite frankly, unless Europe does a U-turn and employ their talents for what is right and just and true, then their energies are misplaced, their objectives are misprioritized, and their efforts futile because the works are dead and they will be burnt up at the judgment. They need their moral compass, as Reverend Thames reminded us this morning. They need their moral compass to be centered on only the truth, the one and only truth, the person of Jesus Christ. So listeners, pray for the intellectuals at the University Faculty of Law. Pray for the persons in URAP, that their hearts are not hardened, will not be hardened, and that they will hear Christ's call to leave the darkness and to embrace true light, true enlightenment, that theirs may be salvation and redemption and commitment of their talents for the common good. Pray for them that they may have a hunger and a thirst for the real abundant life and not cheap substitutes.
Thank you for listening. Send your comments and questions to connect.pray.act@gmail.com. Visit the Facebook page, Connect Pray Act, for more information.